Someone has commented about our studies. They say, as we're going through the wilderness, Kurt, the numbers are picking up. I'm not responsible for that pun. Well, we're going to try to cover a rather lengthy narrative this evening in Numbers 13 and 14. The subject for this evening, the message for tonight's message, is simply this: spies. There has always been a certain mystique surrounding the profession of espionage. The secret agent from without working together with the traitor within has always been a vital element in all warfare, be it Cold War or Hot War. Famous spies of recent vintage include Alan Dulles, the first head of the CIA, Francis Gary Powers, Mata Hari. John Birch was probably the first martyr in the Cold War, and he was a spy. From the realm of fiction, we learn of famous spies such as John Steed and James Bond and the Man from U.N.C.L.E. A host of writers have written about espionage. Some of you may have read the novels of Ian Fleming, Graham Greene, and the master spy storyteller himself, John Le Carré, the master spy storyteller. My father was a spy during World War II on two continents. And there was a time, some time ago, when I seriously considered a career in the field of espionage. Spies. Someone has called spying the second oldest profession in the world. And looking at a certain history of espionage, I came across a good quote. In the opening paragraph to Spies and Spy Masters, A Concise History of Intelligence, Jock Haswall comments, "The earliest recorded intelligence report, dated some 2,000 years before Christ, was written on a clay tablet by a man named Banum, commanding a desert patrol to his lord in Mary, beside the Euphrates, where it was found. It stated that the border villages of the Benjamites were exchanging fire signals, and though the significance of them was not yet known, Banum intended to find out what was going on. He recommended that in the meantime, the guards on the city walls should be strengthened. Then some 600 years after this, there is another tablet with this inscription from a Hittite king to his spy who is being sent to Egypt. He said, 'Bring me back reliable information.'" Well, there are several notable spies and instances of espionage and treason in the Bible. About the same time as that incident that I just quoted a minute ago, Joseph was now assistant pharaoh or vice pharaoh in Egypt. And you remember the incident when his brothers were brought before him and he said, tongue in cheek, "You are spies sent to spy us out." Other spies are mentioned in the Bible, evil spies. Paul in Galatians 2:4 mentions false brethren who were sent in to spy out the liberty of the early Christians. Jude warns of certain persons who have crept in unnoticed with malice on their mind. Perhaps the most famous spy or traitor of all time was Judas Iscariot. Rahab was something of an inside Mata Hari spy, and so was Delilah. So there are many spies and traitors in the Bible. There's an old adage in the study of espionage that goes like this: a spy behind enemy lines can be as valuable as 10,000 soldiers in the field. And there's much truth to that adage. Spies are point men. They're very important. They have to be wise, they have to be trained, and above all, they have to be brave. Because they're going in where no man has gone before, and they have to cover their path, and they have to be very careful. Above all, they have to be brave. A good spy can accomplish much good, and a bad spy can accomplish much harm. Well, I've given that introduction to espionage in general because these two chapters, Numbers 13 and 14, talk about spies in the Bible. Well, this incident is recorded in these two chapters. It's summed up also in Deuteronomy chapter 1, and we're going to refer to both narratives. One of my professors back at seminary says, never take more than one paragraph for a text. He would scream at me if I said I'm going to take two whole chapters. What we're going to do is go paragraph by paragraph quickly through this narrative and see what God has to say about spies, traitors, and the character traits, and see how we can bring out certain character traits in our lives in references to God's promises to us today. The first paragraph, or the first two verses of chapter 13. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Send out for yourself men, so that they may spy out the land of Canaan, which I am going to give to the sons of Israel. You shall send a man from each of their fathers' tribes, every one a leader among them. So Moses sent them out, and so forth. The setting here is in that wilderness, but now they're at a place called Kadesh Barnea. Now, if you compare this with Numbers, with Deuteronomy 1:22, you will see what looks like an apparent discrepancy. Over in Deuteronomy 1:22, it says that there the people called out the spies, and here it says God sent the spies. Well, some of your liberals will say, well, there it clearly shows multiple authorship, or at the very least, a discrepancy in the Bible, an error. There are no errors in the Bible. And some other scholars, such as John Calvin and Kyle, have said that, no, these two can be harmonized. The order is this. First, they asked for the spies, and they asked Moses, and Moses asked God, and God answered by agreeing to the request, and said, I will give you spies, so as it says here in Numbers 13, send these men out to be spies. Now, that's important to see, because that gets back to the very source of their problem. They wanted to know tangible evidence that God's promise is going to happen. They said, don't just send us in there into this promised land without knowing what it's like. God, send us something tangible that we may believe your promise. And so they asked, and they got more than they asked for. You remember the incident we looked at before? They asked for meat, and God said, I'll send you meat. You want meat? I'll send you more than enough meat. It'll come out of your noses. Be careful what you ask from God. You may get what you ask for and more. They asked for spies, and God said, I'll send you spies. And the spies' report gave them more discouragement than their lack of faith in the beginning. So that's part of their problems. Matthew Henry commented, how absurd was it for them to send out spies to a land which God himself had spied out for them. Notice also in verse 2, it says, everyone a leader among them. Now compare that back with Numbers 2, and you may see another apparent discrepancy. Those that would say, well, back there it names men by the tribes that were the leaders, and here we find a new set of names, and this was just a couple of years later. Well, it wasn't that all the previous leaders had died or been replaced. It wasn't a democracy where they were elected every year. But these were the co-leaders. These were like the vice leaders of each individual tribe. These weren't the chieftains of the individual tribes of Israel. Moses would not be sending out the one leader from each tribe, but the right-hand man from each tribe. Also notice, however, that they had to have leadership quality. Every one of them a leader among them. So these weren't just the normal people. These are the ones that had already showed a certain amount of courage, wisdom, training, leadership capability. So from the human perspective, these were the likely candidates to be the good spies. We'll also notice that they come from different tribes. Verses 4 and following mentions the tribe, mentions the man's name, mentions the tribe, the man's name. Covers all 12 tribes. You could see the principle of federal representation here, that each one was representing a tribe, and what he brought back was the representative judgment, perhaps. But we also see that God chose someone from each tribe, lest any tribe felt that they were being left out. And by sending in the tribes, these spies from the tribes were saying, we'll listen to their report. This is fair by us. So we find the list of the tribes. From verses 3 and following, we also see that there were two in particular that are singled out. Now, we're going to talk about Caleb a little bit later, but notice verses 8 and 16. A certain spy by the name of Hoshea, whose name was changed to Yeshua, or as we would say, Joshua. Originally, his name meant the Lord saves, and now it's changed to mean the Lord will save. Now, sometimes a name in Scripture is given special significance, other times not. When a name is changed, and particularly when it sounds similar, there is a significance to it. Moses called his name Yeshua, Joshua, the Lord will save. Because he could see in Joshua not just simply the idea that, well, God is salvation, but God will save. There's a certain faith that he had, a certain courage this man Joshua had in the promises of God for salvation. And so Moses saw that in him and saw that he was a man of faith and of courage, and so he gave him the new name. Verses 17 to 20, we see Moses' commission to the spies. We see, for instance, he says, go there into the Negev, the southernmost region. He says, then go up into the hill country. See what the land is like, whether the people who live in it are strong or weak, whether there are few or many, How is the land in which they live? Is it good or bad? How are the cities in which they live? Are they like open camps, or do they have fortifications? That is, do they have high walls around them? And do they have munitions to protect themselves? How is the land? Is it fat or lean? Are there trees in it or not? Making an effort to get some of the fruit of the land. And then he adds parenthetically, this was the time of the first ripe grapes. Well, this is a good list of duties for any scout, any spy that's sent ahead to scout out, to do reconnaissance, to find out information, bring reliable information. In military parlance, you would say that they are doing reconnaissance to find out the enemy's military numbers and strength, to find out their locations, to find out where their strengths and possible weaknesses are. Also to find out what is their aptitude for war. Are they discouraged? Are all they just waiting, chomping at the bits to fight whoever comes to do battle with them? What is their aptitude for war? What are their economic resources? What are their supply lines? Are they on the brink of salvation and will cave in? Or are they ones that are well fortified with good supply routes back to, for instance, how is the land? Is it fat or lean? Can they provide the food for a battle if we go up against them? Are they ready to fight? Are they willing to fight? And especially, what are the defenses? What are the cities like? Are they walled? Do they have munitions? Do they have big armies? What are the soldiers like? Now, these spies would have some inkling of the lay of the land, but you may wonder, well, they had never been there. How would they know where to go? Moses would just say, well, just follow north and you'll get there. How would they know where they were going? Notice it does go on to say in the next paragraph, they had gone to the Negev, they went to Ahiman, Shashai, Talmai. Well, how did they know where these places were? Were they just wandering around in Israel like they had been wandering in the desert? They didn't have the pillar of cloud to lead them. How were they to know the lay of the land? Well, let me suggest two or three ways. First off, it is possible that Moses had already written the book of Genesis by this time. And the book of Genesis tells you pretty much the geography of the promised land. And so they could have had that. Perhaps they had some maps that they had brought with Egypt from them. But I also think that Moses himself would have given them a map. He said Moses, he'd never been there, didn't have to be there. Moses had been schooled in the Royal Egyptian Academy. Remember, he was raised to become Pharaoh one day. Chances are he would have been well schooled in Middle Eastern geography. He would have known, for instance, where the Negev was and these other places, the hill country. He would have seen the significance to enter by way of the Negev and go to the hill country. And so they learned the lay of the land from Moses. But then you may also ask, well, spies are a dangerous thing. They're going into foreign territory. How are they going to cover their trails? How are they not going to be detected? This is a dangerous thing. Their lives were on the line. How are they going to protect themselves from detection? For example, wouldn't they have been detected by their clothing or their customs or the food that they would eat? Remember, certain foods they could not eat, certain practices they could not do, even on a spying mission? Wouldn't they have been found out by that? And especially their language. Okay, maybe they did learn another language, but they'd still have the accent. How would they not be found out? You may remember the incident where Peter was talking and he was denying Christ. And they said, we know you are one of them. Your accent betrays you. And if you talk to a person from a different part of the country or from another country, no matter how much they've learned your language, learning the accent is one of the hardest things. Wouldn't they have been detected? And you may have also wondered, well, how are these Jews going to know how to talk the language? Are they going to learn, for instance, Hebraic? Or are they going to learn Phoenician or Akkadian or Aramaic? What languages were they going to speak? How would they communicate? Well, perhaps the Jewish spies pretended to be travelers or caravan merchants, whom nobody would suspect because of a strange accent or strange customs. That may well have been. What about the language problem? Well, the chances are that they knew a mutual language. Let's do some logic here. What was the biggest empire on the face of the earth at this time? Egypt. They had just come from Egypt. They had been Egyptian slaves. They had been raised in Egypt. Chances are these slaves, former Egyptian slaves, would have learned Egyptian as well as Hebrew. And if they had gone speaking Hebrew, they would have been found out immediately. But like a good spy that knows another language, go in speaking Egyptian and no one will ever be any the wiser. And also we see that God protected these spies to the best of their ability and above their ability. Now, the fact that God protected them is essential to the whole point here. They went in and came out alive because God protected them. Now, put that on the shelf and we'll get back to that a little bit later. One other thing is we're not told how they went. Did they split up? Did they go individually? Did they go in pairs, like when the Lord sent out the 70 two by two? Or did they go with one roving band of 12? Well, we're not told, so it's not the major point. One point is valid here, is that these were the first Hebrews to go back into the land of Canaan in over 400 years. And the significance of the number of one from each tribe is this. The last Jews that were there were whom? Jacob and his 12 sons had left, remember, to go down to Egypt. And now 12 are going back in there. There is some parallel there. Are they going to go back in faith? You remember the first Hebrew, as it were, that went into the promised land was Abraham. And he went out not knowing where he went, but he followed God, not looking just for normal real estate, but for the city whose builder and maker is God. Would they have the same faith as Abraham, who went in, or the same faith of Jacob when he went out, making his sons promise that they would bring his bones with them? Jacob had the faith that one day they would inherit the promised land. Would they have the same sort of faith of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or of Moses? That brings us down to verses 21 to 24. We're here, we're just told briefly the mission that the spies were on. So they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin as far as Rehob and so forth. He does give two verses here, an interesting one about these enormous grapes, verses 23 and 24, which picks up that parenthesis of verse 20, the time of the first ripe grapes. He said, what is the significance of this? Well, there's a tangible proof that this was good land, fertile land, good production of grapes for wine production. And if you have that kind of good soil, you'll have good soil for any kind of crop that you could ever want to raise. Now, you may look at this and say, well, they're carrying this cluster of grapes on a pole because it was too big for any one man to carry. And some have suggested, well, that means that it was a miraculous land. You know, it's kind of like a genetic engineering. Have you seen what they're doing today where they'll do something with the genes of a certain mouse and it'll make something as big as a cat? Was it something miraculous here? Were there some miraculous horticulture going on? No. The fact that it was so big doesn't mean that it was miraculous. It just simply meant that it was good land. For instance, the Roman historian Strabo uses this very figure of grapes being carried on a pole because no one man could carry it. It's just saying that the land was good and they did as they were commanded. For example, look back in verse 20. Moses, his last order was, make an effort then to get some of the fruit of the land. In verses 23 and 24, they did get it. They brought it back and they carried it back. And I'm sure those hungry, thirsty Jews were saying, man, look at them grapes. Look how big they are. Would you squeeze me one of them into this glass here and make me some good wine? Well, these were out there in the wilderness where they really just had basically water to drink. And so now they were licking their chops saying, look how good it is. And so they brought back a good report and tangible proof of it. But remember what happened just a chapter or two previously when God provided something also for their taste buds, the quail. And they said, look what we've got here, guys. But look beyond that. They hadn't learned their lesson. But they did as they were commanded, and they brought back the grapes. Now, verses 25 to the end of the chapter, we find the spies report back. Well, in addition to the grapes, they remarked that the land flowed with milk and honey. And you find that phrase many times in the scriptures, all the way from Exodus, all the way up into the book of Joshua, and several times after that. What does it mean, it flows with milk and honey? Verse 27, and this is its fruit. What does that phrase mean, milk and honey? Well, some have taken it to mean that, well, there's a lot of cattle there, and a lot of milk cows that can produce a lot of milk. And the honey, well, we're told in another place about many bees producing honey. Which is interesting because later on when it says that they lost to the Amalekite, they fled like bees. Well, maybe using the metaphor of the cattle and the bees. Others have suggested that the phrase milk and honey is simply a metaphor. It's just simply a figure of speech. Well, if so, what does it refer to? Well, if we look at ancient Middle Eastern literature, we will find that phrase in other pieces of literature outside the Bible. And it generally refers to the food that is not so much given to the gods as received from the gods. You study Greek mythology and it talks about nectar, for instance, the food of the gods. What he's saying here is there's something metaphorical about the food there. This is God's food, God's provision for us. And we can go in there and have a feast with each other and with God. It flows with milk and honey. It is a veritable Mount Olympus. But that's not all in their report. It says that they were out for 40 days, verse 28. And in 40 days, whether they had split up, went individually, in pairs, or as a group, a good team of observant spies could make a thorough survey of this relatively small land. They could go around for 40 days, and of course they weren't walking the whole time. I'm sure that Moses sent them out on camels or donkeys. And so they were able to make a pretty thorough survey to learn the lay of the land and the supplies and munitions of the land. But was it a good report? Well, yes and no. They said, yes, the food is everything God promised. Milk, honey, big grapes, grapes as big as watermelons. But the armies are also super big too. Dangerous. Look out. So their good report became a bad report. And get the irony of this. The spies now become traitors. They actually are doing the work of the enemy because they're giving a bad report and they're discouraging God's people. Or at least 10 of the spies did. The problem was twofold. Number one, they said, we are not able to go up against them. In effect, they were saying, God is not able to make good his word and protect us. They were not able to walk across the Red Sea, but God opened up the Red Sea. They were not able to defeat the Egyptians, but God did. But by them here saying, we're not able to do it, they have forgotten God's promise, and it gets back to their disbelief in God personally. And in effect, they were saying, God is not able to protect us. So they were just looking at the men and comparing them with themselves and leaving God out of it. Secondly, you'll notice that they say, down in verse 33, they said, we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so were we in their sight. Or we would say we were like puny ants or midgets compared to them. They say we were like grasshoppers. It's not just saying we were small compared to these giants, but we were jumpy creatures. If you notice, the grasshopper, it sits there and you make a move and it immediately flees away. Grasshopper, a very afraid, shaky sort of creature. And they said, we went in there and we were like grasshoppers. They say, boo, and we jump. And they say, jump, and we say, how far? They say, we were just like grasshoppers. We see here not only their unbelief, but their cowardice. Cowardice. Good spies should be brave, and now these brave spies had become cowards when they came up against something that they thought was just too big for them, and it made them shake in their sandals, and they became cowards. They were saying, we're outnumbered, we're outsized, we're outflanked. And to the best of their so-called espionage wisdom, this is the wise thing. Listen, if we're outnumbered, we'd be fools to go and fight them. If they got us outflanked, we're going to be setting ourselves up for an ambush. If they're better supplied than we are, well, then we'd be fools to either make a treaty or stay out here or go back to Egypt, but this is good logic. Wrong, guys. Bad logic. Also look at verse 33. It says, there we also saw the Nephilim. The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim. Now, some of you may remember that word Nephilim is used back in Genesis 6:4. And however one interprets that incident about the sons of God going into the daughters of women and so forth, whatever one takes that to mean, that cannot be the same group of people here. Because those people were killed in the flood. That was right before the flood. What does the word Nephilim mean? Well, it can be translated giants, as it is in some of the early versions. But these were not literal giants. These were not people 20 feet tall. These were not Greek mythological titans. These were just simply super strong soldiers. These were the best of the best. And they said, we saw the soldiers, but when we saw the Nephilim, we grabbed the grapes and ran. We were scared of these super strong men. For instance, a similar word is used later on to describe Goliath, a man that had been raised to become a soldier, and he was head and shoulders above everybody. He was a hulk of a man, as it were, incredible as it may seem. And they shook in their sandals when they saw the Nephilim. But not all the spies did like that. Joshua, a man of courage and faith, believed God and took courage. But it's particularly Caleb that's singled out in verse 30 and in the next chapter. It says, then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it. Notice two words there that show his strong, courageous faith. We should by all means go up And also, we shall surely overcome them. Those are terms of strong faith and courage. And that's how Caleb is singled out. He was a spy, a soldier, marked by strong courage. He didn't let the 10 spies sway him. He didn't let the crowd sway him. He spoke up to the whole crowd. And his name is Caleb. Now, a point has been made about the name Joshua being changed from Hosea. What does the name Caleb mean? Is there any significance in that? Well, I went thumbing through the sermons of my favorite preacher, Mr. Spurgeon, and he gave a very curious explanation of this. The Hebrew word or Hebrew name Caleb means dog. And you say, that's a bad name for a spy. We think dogs are bad creatures. And Spurgeon came up with a very curious suggestion for this. He says, quote, "A dog is not all badness, that has this virtue, that it follows its master. And therein this Caleb was well named, for never a dog so followed his master as Caleb followed his God." Well, I think that might be a bit fanciful. The word Caleb could also be translated all heart, or courageous, that he was all there and not weak. But Moses doesn't particularly bring out the meaning of the name Caleb, and so I'll just throw that out for your consideration. The thing about Caleb is, however, his faith and his courage and his obedience. Well, what do we learn from this section here? We see cowardice from some of the spies and faith from the minority. What can we learn from that? Well, we can learn, for instance, that true faith will stand the test against all the odds. It doesn't say, well, we're outnumbered, Caleb, why don't we give in? They said, nope, we're not outnumbered. God is on our side. Well, we can also see today that when we go and scout out the land, the earth, the Great Commission, what happens? There are those that will become cowards and will make up excuses. They will say, yes, it is a good land out there, and there's every reason why we should evangelize, but they've got us outnumbered. How can we evangelize the world, the Great Commission? How can we really believe God's promises? Look at the two weaknesses that they threw up here. First off, they said they've got us outnumbered. We're so prone to say the world's got us outnumbered, and Satan is stronger than we are. But also, just like these people, we tend to underestimate God's strength and overestimate Satan's strength. Cowardice is not real humility. Cowardice springs from lack of faith in the promises of God by comparing men with men and us with ourselves, and neither with God. If we look at God and His power, His strength, His promises, we will take courage and we will move on. But they didn't. And so we find the spies becoming traitors. Now we move into Numbers chapter 14, and we see Israel's reply, especially Israel's despondency and mutiny. It says, "Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night." Perhaps this incident happened at night, or it meant that they wept overnight, and then they talked about it the next morning. Whichever is the case, they were despondent, and they were cast down, but their casting down and their unbelief turned to grumbling. Verse 2. "All the sons of Israel grumbled," not just grumbled, but they grumbled against Moses and Aaron. Where'd Aaron come from? Well, we saw a bad thing about Aaron last week, but maybe he learned his lesson. Now he's sticking with Moses. And so they're saying, "Aaron, if you're going to stick with Moses, then you're against us too." Goes on to say, "The whole congregation said to them, oh, that we would have died in the land of Egypt, or that we had died in this wilderness." Now that shows despondency. They're getting hysterical. They're making no sense. They're saying, oh, we're going to die out here in the wilderness, or we're going to go back to Egypt and die. Well, if they're going to die, why aren't they going to Canaan and die? If they're going to die anyway, why not at least give it a try? For instance, we find elsewhere in the Bible a couple of people that are about to die, and they say, why not go into the city? We can only die, and we're going to die out here anyway. And they stepped out in faith, and they got more than enough food. But these people were despondent, and it's like they were threatening a sit-down strike. "We're just going to sit down here and die out in the wilderness, Moses." It's like they were throwing a temper tantrum, similar to previous chapters we've seen in the book of Numbers. Lack of logic. Also, look at verse 3. "And why is the Lord bringing us out into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" At root here, what they are doing is blaspheming God. Not just disbelieving God's promises, but now they're pointing the finger at God and saying, "God brought us out here to murder us in the wilderness." What ingratitude.
God had been feeding them. God had delivered them. God had already killed their enemies back in Egypt. What ingrates. Cowardice and ingratitude generally walk the same path, arm in arm, and together with unbelief and obstinacy. Well, what about Caleb and Joshua? They had the right perspective. Notice how they began to quiet the people. It says in verse 8, "If the Lord is pleased with us, He will bring us into this land. Only do not rebel against the Lord. Do not fear the people of the land. The Lord is with us." Do you see what they're saying? They're saying, guys, you've left the Lord out of this. You're trying to make Him a murderer. He's your protector. He's your deliverer. You can trust in Him if the Lord is pleased, and He is with us. They were saying, we've got to get things from God's perspective. You talk about grasshoppers and giants. God's bigger than any giant, because those giants are like grasshoppers before God. They were trying to quell the rebellion with words that got back to God. But the mutiny didn't end there. It became mutinous. These cowards realized that, Moses, Aaron, Joshua, Caleb, they were not going to lead the people back to Egypt. So they say, let's get new leaders. Verse 4, let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt. So these cowards would cover up their cowardice by murdering the courageous, brave spies and the generals themselves. It was a coup attempt they were attempting. Then in verses 10 to 12, we see God intervening. You remember last week, God interrupted something that was becoming a mutiny. God interrupts this and intervenes. It says here, verse 10, congregation said to stone them with stones. Then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of the meeting to all the sons of Israel. This was that special theophany that would appear in the cloud, and the Shekinah glory would go out, and the voice of the Lord would be heard. A special appearance of God. Well, what did God do? He again talked about His perspective. Notice how He says, verse 11, how long will this people spurn Me? How long will they not believe in Me? They've left Me out of this. In Moses, Caleb, it's not just you that they are disbelieving, but Me. They're spurning Me, and they will not believe in Me. But can you see the exasperation? He says, all the things that I've done, all the signs I've done, and they still won't believe Me. They wanted food, I gave them food. They wanted out of Egypt, I got them out of Egypt. I promised them Israel. And they said, no, they still won't believe Me for all I've done. So He says, verse 12, I'll smite them with pestilence and dispossess them. By the way, have you noticed how often pestilence and plague keeps coming back up in the book of Numbers? Can you see any irony in that? Can you remember any other series of pestilences and plagues? Egypt. God sent plagues upon the Egyptians when they would not let His people go. Now the people are out there, but the people are not going. And so God is sending plagues and pestilences upon them, treating them just like Egyptians, because although they had the flesh of Hebrews, they had the heart of Egyptians. So God said, in effect, in verse 12, I'll smite them and I will make of you a nation greater and mightier. God was saying, I can start all over again. I started all over again with Noah, remember? One man, his wife, and their three kids, and their three wives. I start all over again there. I start all over again with another man, his wife, Abraham. I can start all over again, Moses, with just you, and if you want Caleb and Joshua, fine. But I can start all over again. God is sovereign. But Moses saw this. Verse 13 and following, Moses begins to pray. This was, again, the sign of a good leader. Remember we looked at last week? He prayed for God's forgiveness and for God's healing and God's intervention. Not for God's wrath, but for God's intervention and healing. So Moses prays. But notice how he does it. First off, he does it by pleading God's covenant, God's promises. And he says, Lord, if you don't do this, if you don't bring us in, then everybody's going to blame you. Not the unbelieving spies, not the unbelieving Israelites. In other words, the word had evidently got out that God had delivered His people from Egypt. But if you don't bring them all the way, God, they're going to blame you. The Gentiles are going to blame you and they're going to blaspheme you, Lord. Lord, what about your covenant? Secondly, he pleaded the attributes of God. Verse 17, but now I pray, let the power of the Lord be great, greater than these Nephilim over there in the promised land, just as thou hast declared. He's playing back to God in verse 18 what God had said back in Exodus 33, the Lord is slow to anger. He's pleading God's patience. abundant in loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression. He will by no means clear the guilty. Moses remembers the justice of God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third, fourth generations. You remember that? That's taken from the Ten Commandments. He remembered the law of God. But now the key word comes to this. Pardon, I pray, the iniquity of this people according to the greatness of thy loving kindness. He pleads for God's mercy. It's as if he's saying we deserve it. We're all a bunch of unbelievers, God. We're not pleading for justice. We deserve to die out here, me as much as the rest of them. But Lord, we're not pleading for justice. We're asking for mercy, loving kindness, the hallmark of God's promise and God's covenant. And Moses knew how to get through to God. Verses 20 to 38, we see how God answers this, and he answers the dilemma. On the one hand, if he did wipe out the whole nation, Gentiles would blaspheme. How is he going to be true to his covenant? That's where the wisdom of God comes in. It's like in salvation. How can God honor his justice on the one hand and yet forgive sinners? Does God just simply say, I'm going to forgive everybody? What about his justice? And if he says, I'm going to send them all to hell, what about his purpose of election to save those that he has chosen? How does God handle that? By his wisdom. God wisely came up with the answer here. He's saying, yes, in effect, my covenant is true. And I promise I will bring Israel into the promised land. But I haven't promised any one Israelite that, unconditionally. For any one Israelite to be a partaker of that, they've got to be believers. How many believers do I have out here? Moses, okay. Aaron, well, I don't know about Aaron. Anybody else? Caleb and Joshua. The only ones that would believe. Therefore, God says, I'm honoring my covenant, Moses. You pledged my covenant? Let's look at the conditions of it. Faith. And only two people here, other than yourself, are showing that faith. Therefore, they'll enter and nobody else. Now, you may ask, well, what about this with the children? Verses 29 and 31. Where it says the children, those under 20, well, they'll go too. What God is doing is pointing back to, look back at 14:2. It says, all the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses. And they said, what about our children? Verse 3, our wives and our little ones will become plunder. They were worried about the children. God said, don't worry, I'm the father of the fatherless. I'll take care of your children, even if you don't. You'll die in the wilderness, but I'll take care of your children. From 20 years and below, I'll see them through. So what they were doing was worrying needlessly, and God uses their very worry and despondency against them. Also, we see that God sent yet another plague. Look at verses 36 to 38. What did God do with these 10 spies with the bad report that was spreading not only discouragement, but mutiny amongst God's people? God saw that a good spy that goes bad becomes first a double agent and then a spy for the other side. So God says, these are traitors. They're traitors against my people, against my covenant, against me. And God said, death penalty, capital punishment, and he says, I'll handle it. And he sent a plague. Notice that plague again. And he sent the plague, and they died. However many Israelites died as a result, we don't know. But God punished the ringleaders of these cowardly spies. Last paragraph, verses 39 to 45, we see how did Israel respond to God's answer to Moses' prayer and also God's intervention in punishing these cowardly spies. How did they respond? By presumption. The key word here is down in verse 44. Notice how Moses says, they went up heedlessly to the ridge of the hill country. Again, it's that same hill country where Moses said to go. Good place to start out. Heedlessly, or as some translations have it, presumptuously. And brethren, we need to know what presumption is, because a lot of us slip into it. When we get into a problem, we say, we'll take the easy way out. And that easy way is presumption. What is presumption? Presumption generally goes together with cowardice, disobedience. What it is false faith, false obedience. They're saying, okay, Moses, we learned our lesson. Now we're going to start doing it again. Did God tell them now to go into the land? That's okay, boys. I'll punish the spies and you all continue to go now. Uh-uh. Look back at verse 25. Where God intervened, he says, now the Amalekites and the Canaanites live in the valley. Turn tomorrow and set out to the wilderness by way of the Red Sea. He was saying, Israel, you didn't believe my promise. I'm going to punish these ringleaders. And you have to start all over again back at the Red Sea. You have to go back to square one. But the Israelites said, we don't have to start back at square one. We can pick up again where we are right here. And we can go on. God didn't tell them to go on. God said to go back. So they're disobeying God. They hadn't learned their lesson. There was that still unbelief, still disobedience. It was false courage. It wasn't true courage. It was presumption. And so they went ahead to the Amalekites. God said to go back, but they didn't. They hadn't been truly humbled. We ought to be able to guess what happened. When you step out in presumption, you think God's going to protect a presumptuous unbeliever, unbelieving backslider? No. If he were to do that, it wouldn't be real mercy. It would be giving in to antinomianism and presumption. And so they stepped out from underneath God's umbrella of protection. And God was not with them. And Moses said, the Lord will not be with you. Verse 43. Verse 42, the Lord is not among you. But they said, oh yes, he's with us. Moses, we've learned our lesson. Moses, he stayed back in the camp. So did Caleb. So did the Ark of the Covenant. Verse 44. But they went up. And you can guess the rest of the story. They were defeated. The same will happen to you, brethren, when you step outside of God's direct commands and you step out presumptuously. God will not protect the presumptuous, unbelieving backslider. He will be teaching you a lesson through that. Well, I began by saying that we're seeing several character traits in this passage, good and bad. Let's look at the good. We see Moses, Caleb, and Joshua exemplifying the good character traits. We see the 10 spies and the Israelites in general showing the bad character traits. Moses, Caleb, and Joshua had courage. Everyone else had cowardice. Moses, Caleb, and Joshua had obedience. The others, only obstinacy. Moses, Caleb, and Joshua had faith. The others, presumption and unbelief. Also, the lesson we can learn here is that if you're not a spy, you become a traitor. If you're not doing good for God's people, you're doing bad for God's people. You're bringing a bad report, and your unbelief, your obstinacy, your presumption will spread to other people. You can also learn the good lesson there that just as Caleb and Joshua said, we won't be outnumbered, although the other 10 spies, all Israel doesn't believe, we believe. So you can learn that lesson as well. But as we close, let me throw out one question for you. If you had been one of those spies, or especially one of the Israelites in the desert that day, and you saw the grapes and you heard the good tidings and the bad report, what would you have done? Only by looking into our heart, by the searchlight of God's Word, can we see the character of a true spy or of a traitor in our own hearts. That's the study for tonight in the wilderness. Two whole chapters. And we've ended a little early tonight. So we'll open it up for questions or any spy stories anybody wants to relate. Silence is deafening. There's one.
Is there a correlation here, do you think, between what we study tonight and Christ's word when he says, he is not with me, is against
me? Yeah. Let me pull something out of you. You know what the name Jesus means in Hebrew? Joshua. And so when Greek-speaking Jews read the New Testament, they would think of Joshua and Christ being what, the anti-type of Joshua? Can you see a parallel between those two? He that is not with me is against me. You're not my spy, you're my traitor. Good point. Anyone else?
And oftentimes, there are denominations, group, and so they always is not that you being on fence, but the cross being on fence itself and not you, but simply go and tell the gospel. And yet I find so many objections. Well, it says tonight the giant one is not objection, it says the burden of one. Because it concerns the soul and the love telling them the simple gospel and realizing that all that's all you have to do.
The Lord's purpose of election will be followed. Look at 14:21. That's a good point that I forgot to bring up. When we go out to witness, for instance, we're like going out spies, and the Lord is the one that will save. It's not up to us. We just plant the seed. God brings the harvest. You may have wondered in verse 21, 14:21, where God said, "Indeed, as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord." What's that got to do with God's punishment or encouragement? What the Lord's saying is he's swearing by himself, "As I live, my purpose of glory throughout the whole world will be accomplished by many Israelites going in or by a few, but nobody's going to stop me, not the Nephilim, not the Canaanites. It's going to happen." And so when we witness, somebody may not believe us, but God's going to save his elect, and he's called us to be the means to bring them the gospel. I think a lot of the principles in tonight's lesson do particularly pertain to evangelism. And when you hear someone saying, the harvest is ripe, that's like saying it's a good land. We can go out and evangelize. The Lord will give us the possession of that. That's like a spies report that they're bringing back. And they may even bring back the tangible evidence or the good report, like Caleb and Joshua saying the Lord will be with us. It'd be a good idea to heed that advice and to follow in that courage and not become cowards. Any other comments? Yes. Okay, some have suggested that the history of the world is simply one of men and women inventing new and more and greater ways of sinning. And there's a lot of truth to that, but God has also got his line of progression through the covenants and more people coming to know him. Some have suggested, on the one hand, often quoting this, that things will get better and better and better so that God's good will progressively outnumber the bad, so that by the time Christ comes, it'll be virtually a kingdom of God on earth in a great kingdom age. In case you don't know what this is, that's post-millennialism. Then there are others that'll quote this verse and say, well, there is already a certain amount of glory everywhere in the world. Holy, 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 the whole world is filled with your glory, it says several times in Scripture. Already creation tells us something of the glory of God, but not to the fullest degree. It one day will. Will that be progressively until the coming of Christ? I don't think so. I think that ultimately, so far as time and history are concerned, this refers to the millennium, when the world or the earth will be filled with his glory, when all sin will be restrained, and then, of course, there will be the eternal state. But God's purpose will be progressively fulfilled, and I think that slowly he will keep certain kinds of sin in check. I would say that evil is getting worse, and good is getting better.
I think that in due proportion. And then one day God will set the balances completely and the whole world will be filled with His glory. Any other comments or questions before we close? Yes. Antinomianism. Okay, twin brother of Mr. Presumption. Antinomianism is the sort of belief that says we don't need God's law. We don't need any law. Basically, it means against law. Any law. Being a law unto ourselves in the political realm, that would be called anarchy. In the realm of righteousness and ethics, we call it antinomianism. Personified in the question put to Paul in Romans 6 and 7, well, if we're, saved by grace, we can sin any way we want to, can't we? Or if we're, not under the law, can't we just sin that grace abounds all the more? And Paul says, no. He checks out antinomianism. Fair enough? Well, let's close with prayer, and perhaps if you have any more questions or comments, come and see me afterwards. Father, there's no need for us to send out spies because you know all things. But Father, you have commissioned us to go into the world and preach the gospel and to believe your promises, all of your promises, in all of our lives. Give us that same spirit of faith and of obedience and especially of courage, Father, like these mighty men of old. May that be the hallmark of everyone in this room tonight. In Jesus' name, amen.